When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
I'm Megan Murphy, host of The Same Drugs. I'm here to have conversations. Real, honest, authentic conversations. The kind we aren't supposed to have anymore. I interview anyone I find interesting, from left to right to everywhere in between. I work independently in order to have the freedom to say what I believe and speak to whoever I want. Staying independent has allowed me to speak freely and to tell the truth, no matter how unpopular, for many years now, and I wouldn't trade that for anything. We have seen over the last few years how deeply compromised big media is, and how willing mainstream journalists are to twist facts and hide the truth to sell a narrative. I opted out of mainstream media and a traditional career path for a reason. I want to come to my own conclusions and not be compromised by financial, political, or ideological limitations. I refuse to trade my integrity or my free speech for a paycheck. But that means I need your help. I rely on donors and patrons, so individuals like you, to support my work so that I can continue to do what I do. If you appreciate the kinds of conversations we're having at The Same Drugs and wish to support my work, a great way to do that is by becoming a subscriber on Patreon. That's patreon.com/Megan Murphy. On Substack at www.meganmurphy.ca, where subscribers can be sure not to miss a single episode, can access subscriber-only video content and engage with the comments section, subscriber-only chats and AMAs, and you can keep up with my writing there as well. Or you can just do a really easy thing, which is to click follow on the Same Drugs podcast page on Spotify and support this podcast directly there by clicking the support button. Thank you so much for supporting Conversations Outside the Algorithm. Today on the show, I am speaking with one of my favorites, Batya Ungar Sargon, the author of a new book called Second Class: How Elites Betrayed America's Working Men and Women. Batya, I'm so excited to see you again.
I am virtually. So thrilled to be here with you. I find you to be one of the most intelligent, brave, and inspiring people on the internet. So this is a real pleasure for me.
You always say very complimentary things, and it makes me feel like, I don't know, embarrassed because it's not true or something. But that's how I feel about you also. Like, I was reading your new book, which I'll show everyone.
Yay!
And I just think it's like the most important book. I just can't tell you what it means to me. And like, no, I feel like no one else is telling these stories and no one else really gets it. And I can only imagine how validating and meaningful it would be to working class Americans. And as somebody, you know, I grew up working class and I was always proud to be working class and also like hateful of the upper classes. And I feel so validated.
That's music to my ears.
My true bigotry is it's really just against the rich.
That's hilarious. Thank you so much for saying that. That means a lot to me. The whole process was extremely humbling, and I still feel very like just beyond grateful to the people who shared their stories with me, and like grateful to God that this was fell into, you know, to my lot to tell this story. You know, my first book, Bad News, I feel like it made people really angry. And this book is having, like, people are telling me that it makes them really sad, but I'm like, no, be angry. Like, all of this can be fixed tomorrow. And So I hope people are reading it in that spirit.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I got out of it. I'm so relieved to know that there's changes that can be made in America that can have a real positive impact on the working class, because it does often feel hopeless. And as you point out, politicians like Obama, for example, behave as though it's, you know, this is just how it is. And now this is just how the world is, and there's nothing that we can do about it, and we just kind of have to fit in somehow. I think one of the things that you pointed out that I hadn't thought of before or hadn't noticed was that this idea that you now have to have a college degree to move up in the world, you know, that class mobility and the American dream is for some inexplicable reason dependent on having a college degree that may well be completely irrelevant to the work that you're doing or the job that you're trying to move up into. And yeah, people like Obama and Clinton as well behave as though this is just how the world is, but it doesn't have to be this way.
It's funny that you say for some inexplicable reason. Like, there's a very good reason for it, which is that, like, the college educated built an economy that was effectively an upward transfer of wealth from the middle class to the college credentialed elites. So, you know, it's you're right that Obama and Clinton made it sound like this was inevitable. But that's what the elites always do. They make it seem like everything that benefits them is natural, you know, is like the natural way of things, is inevitable, right? And everyone else should just suck it. When actually what they did was they very intentionally put in place policies in which the elites plundered the middle class, like in the name of progress, right? That's effectively what the last 50 years have been. Like, the Democrats, who used to represent the working class, created a whole bunch of policies that in effect took an economy where the largest sector used to be in manufacturing and the largest share of the GDP used to be the middle class, and they squeezed it in both directions. So if you got a college degree, you got squeezed up into the top 20%, which now controls over 50% of the GDP. So the vast majority of the GDP is now in this over-credentialed college elites right now, and then squeezed the working class down basically into, you know, the lower classes and made them second-class citizens.
Yeah, it's just, you know, the fact that it was, you know, and working class people, as you'll learn if you read your book, and, you know, I think I knew this a little bit, but also was appreciative to see in your book, is that, you know, the working class are proud, and they're proud to work hard, and they're proud of the work that they do, and they're proud to provide for their families, and they're proud to provide a home to their families. And that's becoming harder and harder and harder. And those elites, those people in charge are making it harder and harder. You know, it's not, as you say, it's not just some accident. But I wanna talk a little bit more about the data around what's actually happening to the working class and why it's getting harder and harder for the working class to make it and to participate in what once, I think, probably could have honestly been called the American dream.
Yeah. So the barriers to the American dream for the working class are in things like housing. If you live in a blue state or a metro area, and you have a working class wage, if you're making, you know, $50,000, $60,000, $70,000, $80,000, $100,000 a year, you're not gonna be able to own property. You'll never be able to buy a home. And so if you consider, like, the American dream to be, well, I'll tell you how working class people define it, and how, you know, both the people I interviewed and also the polling, most people, if you ask them, what's the American dream, they'll describe kind of a stable middle class life. They'll say owning your own home, being able to retire in dignity, having adequate healthcare, and your children have at least as many options as you did, choices as you did, right? That's kind of, those are the rubrics, the sort of the most modest version. And increasingly, working class people can't afford to buy homes. They have no savings on which to retire. Healthcare has become extremely expensive, and their children are downwardly mobile. So they've sort of lost access to those things. Not everybody, but the formula that if you work really hard, you will succeed in the most modest version of the American dream, that has become untrue. It's now basically a crapshoot. You can do everything right, and still it's just a 50-50 chance you might be able to make it, but you might not. And that is the thing that feels really unfair to them. Like you said, they're very proud of their work. And yet these jobs at which they toil away, like physically demanding jobs, they work harder than I ever will. And most of the people in our class in the knowledge industry, they work really hard. They're really proud of that work. And yet those jobs are not enough to secure them a stable life. And the left, their answer to that is always, well, we'll just give them more welfare. We'll give them food stamps. We'll give them affordable housing. We'll give them vouchers. We'll give them free childcare. They don't want any of that. Whether they're Democrats or Republicans, every person I interviewed said they would rather like make more at their job. They don't want something for free. You don't get dignity out of that. You can't get self-esteem or self-respect from being handed something. And the left fundamentally cannot understand that, that working class people, whether they're Democrats or Republicans, they value their autonomy. They value self-determination. They value their work. And that's sort of the elites don't get that at all, because the elites value paternalism. They value big government. They value these institutions because the institutions have delivered so much to them.
Well, yeah. And I think that autonomy word is key, because the thing about being handed something, you know, if you're relying on the government to survive, that can be taken away in an instant. It doesn't provide you with any autonomy over your life at all. It's totally dependent on what the government decides to give or not.
Totally. And I think throughout COVID, it's become so clear how irresponsible the government is when it comes to our rights, how eager and willing it is to sort of take them away. Working class people really just want to be left alone. I mean, they don't buy into this idea of policing other people's thoughts and other people's feelings. It's just so not their thing. They just want to be left alone. They just want the economy to protect their labor and in exchange give them the dignity of autonomy, of self-determination. And this is kind of lost on the elites of both sides.
Yeah. One of the quotes that I love from the book was something along the lines, I think I'm paraphrasing a little bit, but you know, the Democrats, essentially these kind of elite progressives, are paying off the working class and then hiring a slave class from failed socialist states, as you called it, to do that work for very, very cheap.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So the selling out, the betrayal of the working class by the progressive elites, it started with Clinton, who signed NAFTA into law and shipped 5 million good working class manufacturing jobs overseas to China and Mexico to build up their middle class. Then President Obama defunded vocational training. So this other robust avenue to the middle class for working class people, the skilled trades, basically disappeared. And then Joe Biden continued the trend of opening the border and welcoming in millions and millions, tens of millions of people to compete with working class people for the jobs that remained here, devaluing them both financially and spiritually and psychologically with this idea like these jobs are beneath the contempt of, you know, the elites, and thus beneath you if you're an American. I mean, this was all like a wholesale selling out of the working class. And each of these things put money back in the pockets of the college educated elites while immiserating the working class. Because to the elites, if you make $60,000 a year as a janitor, you're effectively poor. I mean, they don't value that work. They sneer at it. They think it's beneath contempt. So they don't see a difference between a working class person who's clinging to the dignity they get from their job and a poor person who's just living off the government. And so their vision, the progressive vision of the economy, is basically, you know, everyone should go to college, where basically you become like a good member of, you know, the left, right? A member in good standing of the left. You become woke because you become indoctrinated. And then you get a knowledge industry job that pays $150,000 to $500,000 a year, right? These are the people who are like the real citizens. And then all of the manufacturing should be done in China by slaves in Xinjiang, right? And all of the service industry jobs should be done by, you know, people who are enslaved to the cartels, who are imported from failed socialist states. And then what should happen to the 70% of Americans who are working class? Well, they should live on universal basic income. They'll get paid off, like you said, to just sit at home and watch TV on their flat screen TVs in, you know, affordable housing that's paid for by the government. That is the fantasy but that is actually the economy that the Democrats have built, right? I mean, that is literally what they're trying to instantiate. And the working class is just like, what are you doing? Like, in what universe are you going to have a stable democracy in a situation like that? I mean, it's obviously insane. And yet it is so natural to them. Like, to them, this is the most natural thing. If you bring up any of the issues in my book, they'll say to you, well, obviously, like, you know, they'll call me a Luddite, you know, that I'm resisting progress, as if people aren't still doing those manufacturing jobs just in another country, right? Like, as if there's ever going to be a time that we don't need plumbers. Like, it's just so insane, you know, like, this is your brain on like a miasma of like Silicon Valley autism and then like progressive sneering at the working class, right? Like, this, they have no concept of like what the actual world looks like when it's inhabited by humans who care about each other and respect each other. And, you know, it's insane.
Which is funny, because they think, and I'm saying they because this is exactly how I thought when I was a Marxist or a socialist. You know, I sort of oscillated between those two identities for most of my life, right? But this is how I thought. And I thought that what I was advocating for was this kind of ideal world wherein everybody, you know, would be on UBI and, or, you know, getting enough money from welfare, and there would be affordable housing, and there would be universal daycare, and all of these things that I thought would just make life better for everyone. But practically, that's not how things work. I mean, you know, one of the interesting things about what you just said is that, and this is also expressed in your book, of course, is that, you know, the way that the middle and upper classes think about working class jobs is revealed. It's revealed to me, in any case. I don't know what you think about this, but in the way that the left talks to me about prostitution, because they'll say like, oh, well, like, you know, nobody wants to clean toilets either. Or would it be better to be flipping burgers than be like working in the sex industry, to be essentially like trafficked and, you know, paid, or your pimp is getting paid anyway to be raped all day long? I shouldn't be laughing at all, because it's not funny. But, you know, like, that's the comparison. And it's like, wait, do you think that like people who clean houses or clean hotels, like all these like thousands and thousands and thousands of people who are cleaning toilets and also changing bed sheets and cleaning hotel rooms or flipping burgers or working at McDonald's or whatever, do you think that these people are, you know, the way that you think about these people is with disgust. You think that what they're doing is disgusting and embarrassing and not worthy of any respect whatsoever.
That is such a smart point. You know, I've often pointed out that to the left, no one can consent to sex except prostitutes, right? Have you noticed that? Like, all sex has become effectively rape, like, unless you're like a prostitute.
Unless you're getting paid for it.
Exactly. In which it's like actually probably the closest to rape, right? Somebody who's like actually doesn't want this to be happening. Yeah. But that is a really good point. I mean, comparing sex work to, you know, other forms of working class labor is so disgusting. And you're so right. It reveals how little they actually like, that they think that cleaning a toilet is the equivalent of, they would rather be raped than clean a toilet. And that is so telling. That's such a good point.
Yeah. Like, it's so strange. I mean, I thought of this as I was reading your book. So you made the point without being so, you know, literal about it. But I want to know I think I'm not sure we all know what we're talking about when we're talking about the working class. And it does vary, you know, it's not just about income, right? So when we're talking about the working class, who are we talking about? What does that mean? What does working class mean?
Right. So it's a really hard thing to define, you know, like obviously there's like working class vibes, you know, but I wanted to come up with like a good definition. And the whole introduction is sort of me bringing examples of people and telling you like in snippets, like their stories and to be like, okay, here's how I arrived at this definition. But it's very hard because like we know what we're talking about. Like we're talking about the people whose lives have become really, really hard, even though they work really hard. So a lot of people will say to me like, you know, well, you know, they'll talk to me about the poor and I'll say, this is not a book about the poor. You know, this is a book about the working class. There's a lot of working poor and they are in the book, but it's fundamentally about people who are working and struggling to achieve the American dream. So how did I end up defining it? A lot of academics define it in different ways. The definition I found the most compelling because it came closest to delineating that dividing line that I believe is central to American life today, the class divide, is people who work in jobs that do not require a college degree or skills you would learn in college, mm-hmm. who have been locked out of the top 20%. So I'm not talking about like, you know, plumbers who made it really rich or contractors who are, you know, pulling in, you know, $250,000 a year. I'm talking specifically about people who work in industries that don't require skills picked up in college and yet are not rich, have been locked out of, you know, the top 25%, top 20% who are controlling all of the GDP. And I think with that definition, clunky though it is, it's really narrowing in on the people that I was trying to describe. And what I found was when you think about the working class that way, there's sort of three tiers. There's the top tier, who I call rising working class, who really are middle class or have a middle class lifestyle. If you think about middle class as defining a way of life, as achieving the American dream, they're homeowners, they have a retirement fund or a pension, their children are, you know, have as many choices as they did, and they have affordable health care through their job or, you know, through your spouse's job. They have, you know, access to health care. There's also the working poor, people who work and work and work and are simply living in poverty and constantly having to call the electric company to beg forbearance. The income they make from their one job, two job, three jobs is not enough to stave off poverty. And then there's the sort of middle tier who I call floating. And these are people who are able to cover their bills. You know, they're not sort of beset by poverty, but their lives are precarious because they cannot achieve the American dream. They have no savings for retirement because a lot of their savings go to healthcare costs and home ownership is totally out of reach for them because of where they live. If they live in blue states and blue cities, especially, they'll never be able to afford a home. And this is the largest group in the working class, actually. And, you know, the different industries and jobs and they really correspond to these. So a lot of truck drivers and certified nurses aide are in that sort of floating category. They're actually making more in wages now than they probably did before the pandemic, but home ownership is like totally out of reach. A lot of civil servants are in the sort of upper category, people in the medical field, cops, firemen, a lot of skilled trades folks are in that sort of, you know, electricians and so forth. Welders are in that top tier. And then in the bottom tier, you have people doing retail, people doing gig work. Although a lot of people I met surprised me. So I met homeowners who were, cleaning people, janitors, who worked for Amazon. A lot of like very happily employed people at Amazon, which you don't really hear from in the sort of mainstream leftist accounts as much. I also was very surprised because we're told a lot about the success sequence. The right really likes this idea that, you know, if you graduate from high school, get married before you have kids and get a job. There was some survey that found that, you know, only, you know, that, you know, 95% of people who followed that sequence were not poor. But I actually found in my interviews, there was very little correlation between that and whether people made it or not. I met a lot of people who had had children with a number of partners, then found the right man, settled down and were homeowners and were living sort of in dignity and had the American dream. I also met a lot of people who were married, had gotten married before having kids, have been employed since they were 13 years old and were living in poverty. There was very little correlation there. And I think that was the main takeaway from the people that I interviewed was like, you can do everything right and still only have a 50-50 shot of making it into the middle class.
So why is that happening now? You know, for example, like one of the individuals that you featured a lot in the book, which I was really happy about because I've had him on my podcast now twice, Gordon McGill. And I just think he's so great. And I've learned so much from him. And he's just like such a wonderful, smart guy. But he's a trucker. He works really hard. He has a family. His partner is also working. And home ownership is totally out of reach for them. And it is nonsensical and it's unfair. And this was one of the primary concerns that came up for a lot of people that you talked to. Why is that? What's changed? What's happening now that's made this the reality for the working class?
So it was a combination of factors. Number one was the great sorting. So where a lot of like these over-credentialed college elites moved to cities and urban areas and the coasts. And now it used to be that, you know, back in the day, doctors would marry nurses and lawyers would marry paralegals and accountants would marry secretaries. And so you had a kind of sharing of the wealth between the classes. But something very crazy has happened recently, which is that, you know, in the past 10, 20 years, doctors have started to marry doctors and accountants to marry accountants and lawyers have started marrying lawyers. And you have this now, this class endogamy. So where it used to be that you would have a doctor, you know, probably be making good money, but he'd be, you know, the single homeowner, the single breadwinner in the family. You now have two of those people. Elizabeth Warren called this the two-income trap back before she was a progressive. So now what you have is, you know, all of these over-credentialed people living in urban areas, living in blue states and cities. And instead of competing with, you know, there, you know, let's say a couple where you have one electrician and maybe like a part-time librarian, right, who maybe together are, you know, bringing in something comparable to the doctor, right? Now what you have is two doctors who together are bringing in $500 to $1 million a year, and their cleaning lady who's making 40. And she's now competing with them, or Gord and his wife, who each make $50,000 a year, so combined income of $100,000 a year, are now competing with couples who make $1 million a year for the same dwindling stock of housing. And to make matters worse, these two doctors are extremely good at working the system. They belong to their community board. They're very active in local politics. They know how to have fundraisers for local politicians. And they passed all sorts of NIMBY laws that basically resulted in 78% of the land that is zoned in the United States for housing is zoned for single family detached housing, meaning that, you know, in their wherever these couples live, most of the land that is available for building houses is zoned that you can only build one family homes on it to protect the value of their homes. So meaning like in a bygone era, there's a parcel of land opens up, you know, somebody dies and a developer could show up and say, hey, I'm going to build a duplex here and sell, you know, two homes for $750,000 to two middle-class families as starter homes. Right. And we'll see, you know, I could get twice as much, you know, not twice as much, 1.5, whatever. But now because it's been zoned for single family detached, that developer can only build a McMansion on that property because they can only build one home. And to make it worth their while, they have to make it be a big home. So these couples are now not only hoarding the American dream, but they're really making it impossible for everybody else, for people like Gordon and his wife, Jenna, to ever buy even a starter home. Getting rid of zoning laws tomorrow would immediately free up 1 million units in 1 year, and we would solve our housing crisis in 10 years. But of course, this, you know, is not really on anybody's radar because working class people do not have the time to show up at these community board meetings and say, hey, these zoning laws are actually like extremely punishing for us. And these rich progressives like have just been getting away with this for decades.
It's just, it's so funny because this is exactly what's happening on these little Gulf islands in BC. So I know about this because I abandoned Vancouver when I was like 26 to go live in a tent on this little island that was populated by about 1,000 people for a while. And, so this has been going on now for about 10 or 15 years, and it's just progressively gotten worse and worse and worse. And it's this thing where you're only allowed to build one home on a plot of land, and you're not allowed to build a secondary home. So what happens is that, you know, people who are working class can't afford to live there, in part because they can't have a rental property on their property so that they can get income. But on top of that, working class people have nowhere to live on any of these islands, because if you can't afford to buy a home, there's nowhere to live because there's no rental properties. There's not like a little cabin on somebody else's bigger property that you can rent. And the same thing is now happening on a Gulf island that my parents live on. It's a constant argument with these. It's called the Islands Trust Unit. I don't know how much insider information you need about
this is
a tiny Gulf island in
BC. This is so interesting.
It's been an argument between the working class and the upper class on these little islands for a very long time. And the Islands Trust is basically run by these well-off older white people, because they're retired and they have money and they have time to dominate these bylaws and these conversations and these debates. It's funny because it's so, you know, they all need working class people to live
right
on these islands.
Exactly.
Because who's going to build their houses, and right, who's going to chop all their wood, and who's going to take care of their property and their lawns, and who's going to cut down their trees, and like, where are they going to buy their eggs from? Like, it's so, they aren't thinking even selfishly for themselves, but it's just, it's creating these islands that are populated entirely by the most well-off, most useless, least interesting people. Like, who's going to go to the pub? It affects the entire economy. Nobody's buying the weed. Nobody's going to the bar. Like, all these places can't make it. Then there's no jobs for the people who would be working in the bars or the restaurants. Like, and it drives me crazy. And, you know, and actually, and then it affected my family personally. I've been angry about this for a lot of years, but my dad's been trying to build like a little cabin on their property so that either they can rent it out to somebody who's working on the island or whatever, or I can stay there when I come there. And they put a stop to the work because there's, you know, you can't have like a bathroom in there. You can't build up one level so that there can be a bedroom, because you're not allowed to build something that somebody else can live in. That's what the rule is.
Terrible. And what's amazing is like the left's answer to this is always like, well, let's build, you know, a high rise for homeless people in the middle of, you know, this island, which
let's
is like
somewhere for the fentanyl addicts.
Exactly. That is like, that is their advocacy. Exactly. Exactly. It's like that's their view of like, you know, there's homeless people. Let's just like put them all in this like, you know, nice middle class neighborhood. It's like, no.
We'll put them in these shipping containers.
They're just so totally focused on like the wrong things.
Anyway, yeah, it's crazy. And it's just
wait,
so
I want to hear more about you living in this tent.
Oh, okay. So in 2006, I guess I had like some kind of Saturn returns breakdown. Like, you can't call it like a midlife crisis because I was only 26 years old, but I just felt trapped in my life because I was working as a receptionist. I'd always, you know, since I graduated from high school, I was doing admin jobs that pay very badly. You know, you're making like $13 an hour. I'm barely able to pay rent. You're in this terrible cycle. You're in a miserable job. And so it's like, you go out and party on the weekends and then you're back to work. And I was just like depressed, and I wanted to go back to school and I couldn't go back to school. I was sort of trying to take night classes, but you can't actually finish or really get anywhere in a BA just taking night classes, mm-hmm, because first of all, most classes are not offered at night, and it took me 10 years to get through my BA as it was, but you know what I mean? Like, time-wise, you can't just be taking one class a semester and make it through a BA. And I just didn't know what to do. Like, my parents had moved to the States for work. My mom had gotten a job at IU, And so it wasn't like I could just move back home. So my solution was to go on EI and like leave my house and go live on a tent on an island. I had also read this book by Derek Jensen that was called, oh my gosh, I'm going to forget what it was called. I think it was the first book that he ever wrote.
Is it like Leave Your Life Behind and Live in a Tent on an Island?
No, but that's what I got from the book somehow. Like, I decided like I didn't want to live in the city anymore and I wanted to like be closer to the land. And I, you know, was interested in anarchy, and you know, I was like, I'm gonna go feed chickens and pick berries on the island. And it turns out that I hate labor and farm work, so that was a useful learning experience for me in that regard. But other than that, it was great in a lot of ways because it just changed the trajectory of my life. So while I was on the island, I got involved with the pirate radio station, which was in the middle of a sheep field in a trailer. And I was able to actually start going back to school when I was on the island because I was working at the local cafe and my rent was super cheap. I was just living in a little cabin that didn't have any plumbing or heating on a friend's property.
Wow.
And so my rent was really cheap. So I could just work a few days a week at the cafe. And then I was doing courses online and commuting a bit to the university that I had to like take a ferry to and like carpool down the island. It sounds funny when I say it all out.
It sounds really charming. Like, it sounds very Eat, Pray, Love. And like, did you find yourself? And
In a way, because yeah, like it completely changed the trajectory of my life and led me to where I am now, because I did finish school and I ended up doing a master's degree and I got into doing radio. So while, you know, through this pirate radio station, I realized that I really liked doing radio and I wanted to get into doing journalism. So I eventually, when I did move back to Vancouver, I started doing a radio show at the local co-op radio station and started writing and started doing journalism-y kind of stuff. And I was, I didn't feel like trapped in this terrible cycle of not making money and not really being able to escape and not having any kind of freedom or autonomy and not being able to move into a different direction. And just like the being trapped in this sort of like, I'm going to make, you know, whatever, $27,000 a year working as a receptionist for the rest of my life because you can't move up. I was working for the government actually at that time, unless you have more advanced degrees. Anyway, back to your book. And here I am now living in a little town in Mexico among the roosters. So not in a tent though, but also in other strange circumstances. I think that like one of the very nice things that I think that everyone should know, and I think there's so many important messages that should come out of your book that I hope people will pay attention to, is that people are not as divided as politicians and the media and social media pretends that they are. You know, you interviewed a lot of people across America who were very diverse in terms of their lives and what they were doing, but they were also, you know, they shared some politics and then not others. You know, they weren't all voting Democrat. They weren't all Trump fans. What did you find was similar across the board? And what did you find was different? What did you find was different or notable politically about the working class versus the people that we hear from most, which are, you know, these middle class or elites?
So the working class is totally not polarized. Everyone I spoke to knew people, worked with people, prayed next to people who thought differently about things, who voted differently, and it would never occur to them to hold that against them. They don't have any emotional or spiritual attachment to politicians in the way that the elites do. They are very transactional and practical about politics. But also, Megan, I found so much consensus, like even among like working class people who voted for Democrats and who voted for Republicans. And I think this is like, if the main headline of the book is like, you know, polarization is a totally elite phenomenon. Definitely, like, the second headline here is, like, the vast majority of working class people agree on what policies would help them, whether they are liberals or conservatives. So, for example, like, nearly everybody I interviewed was super pro-gay, including the Christians that I interviewed. And they were, like, just wanted the gay people in their lives to be treated with respect, to find love, to settle down. Like, it was really remarkable hearing that from very religious Christians. In fact, they really liked that Trump was pro-gay. That's how they saw him. But they were really, really worried about the trans agenda. So, like, in their mind, there's no LGBTQ thing. That's not a thing. There's, like, the gay people that they know. And then there's, like, drag queen story hour and trans athletes in women's sports beating on women and trans athletes with penises in women's bathrooms, all of which they really hated. And like that, there was no contradiction there for them the way there is on the left, right? Like there was no contradiction there. The politics of Amy, a certified nurse's aide I met in Florida, and Linda, an Amazon driver who I met in West Virginia, I can't point to anything that distinguished them, even though Amy is a lesbian Biden voter and Linda was a huge Trump supporter. They agree on like basically everything. The working class wants a total moratorium on immigration and some sort of government-backed healthcare plan, right? Like that's sort of, so they fall between the two parties because each party, okay, yeah, the Democrats care about healthcare, but they opened the border, right? The Republicans care about securing the border, but they'll never talk about healthcare. Like the first party to arrive at that combination of like, let's make sure no one has like medical bankruptcy and let's secure the border and put like a stop on immigration for a while is going to have a ruling majority because 70% of Americans want that. And yet they're forced to choose between two parties. They really didn't like welfare, but they also supported raising taxes on corporations and the rich. Like they had, I would say like the thing that characterizes working class Americans the most is an extreme moderation on all things. They're deeply, deeply moderate people and deeply, deeply tolerant people.
Yeah. And I mean, the immigration issue I think is an important one, especially right now. You know, the way that it's portrayed is that if you are in any way opposed to immigration, you're a racist, you're xenophobic. And the one of the ways that you described it in the book was that you said when educated Americans talk about illegal immigrants, they talk about them in moral terms. So they're not really thinking of it in realistic terms, and they think of it in very different ways than the working class do.
Yeah, but they're also full of shit because it's totally in their economic interest, right? So, you know, they like to act like it's this moral question and all these people are refugees and blah, blah, blah. But the truth is that it puts money back in their pockets to have an open border because they are the consumers of illegal migrant labor. And so when they have to pay a nanny $9 an hour or even $15 an hour instead of what they would have to pay an American citizen, right, which they would have to pay her $20 an hour, $25 an hour and give her healthcare, it's putting money back in their pockets and they know it. But they like to masquerade as the good guys, you know, and basically they're it's class warfare on the working class. Like it's an upward transfer of wealth from the working class. It's wage theft to welcome in millions and millions of people to compete with working class Americans so that you have to pay less for that labor that you're consuming.
And did you find that the people that you talked to for this book were opposed to immigration, or is it that they're opposed to illegal immigration? You know, like what's their view on
they're immigration? Like, why are we bringing it? They post the illegal immigration a lot, but also like, why are we giving H-1B visas for good jobs to people who aren't Americans instead of training Americans to do those jobs? Like it made no sense. Like the whole Obama thing was we're going to retrain everybody to do those jobs. Instead, all that happened was we imported those people from India, you know, legally. Right. Why? Like they're not, this whole thing was designed as a plunder of the middle class for the elites. And every single policy agenda item was about leaving the working class behind in the dust.
Yeah. You know, part of what I understood it to mean to be, you know, on the left throughout my life was that, and I still am, you know, I'm a big supporter of unions. And I wonder, I'm curious to know what the working class now thinks about unions. Are they a good thing? Are they a bad thing? I mean, I don't know. It's so tough because the unions in Canada are, I hate them, you know, yes. They're propaganda arms for the NDP, yeah. Which is our, you know, our leftist party in Canada, which are, you know, it's just a woke party. Like they're not interested in what the working class think right. at all. They completely vilified the trucker convoy as these extremist white supremacist Nazis. They forced the mandate, the vaccine mandates on workers, you know, which essentially forced, you know, hundreds of thousands of people out of work. They're forcing trans politics on people and don't care at all that working class families don't like what's going on and they don't want their girls to be sharing change rooms with men at the pool or, you know, being forced to compete against men in sports or whatever it is. You know, they just, they're completely authoritarian and they're completely insulting to the working class.
And they hate the Jews.
And they hate the Jews, I know. And they're sadists. They're like, all this rape and murder, I feel, this is so liberating.
Right, right, totally. Yeah, so it's a little bit, the situation.
They love terrorists.
It's a little better in America. We don't, like, the rank and file of most unions that are, like, now, I'm not talking about like the New York Times union where the average worker makes $160,000 a year, you know? I'm talking about like the, not the desk unions, like the actual workers' nice. Unions, because their rank and file is basically like, obviously like very keen on Trump. The leadership in a way in some of them, like the Teamsters, for example, like they have been moderating a lot. And there is definitely that cultural gap between the national union leadership and the rank and file, but they really don't like kind of bang them over the head with it. Unions in America are extremely popular, but only 6% of the private sector is unionized. And the question is why, right? Like Americans are very keenly aware right now of the power that unions give their workers, and yet they're not rushing to join them. And I believe it's because, you know, the main gap between the national union leadership and the workers is not over the woke stuff, although they have a little bit of that, but they are, it's much better than in Canada. It's over immigration. The unions in the 1990s, just like the rest of the Democratic Party, did a 180 on immigration and started to support mass migration and illegal migrants. And they basically threw their weight behind the direct competition. And I think that is really the dividing line. I think working class Americans saw that and were like, I mean, sure, I could belong to this union, but A, they don't share my values. Maybe they're giving money to, you know, Planned Parenthood and they don't like that, you know, but they would have gotten over all of that if it wasn't clear that they were actually on the side of bringing in millions and millions of migrants from failed socialist states. And so I think that was really where the unions, they made a huge miscalculation because working class people noticed. And it's one of the reasons I think the membership is not commensurate with how much Americans, even conservative Americans, appreciate the work that unions do.
Are you a supporter of unions? Do you think yeah. unions are? Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Anyone who cares about the working class should support unions. I worker power, collective bargaining. How can you ask a single person to stand up to a corporate billion-dollar corporate multinational corporation that barely cares that it's American, you know? Yeah. Like a lot of these places are, what does it even mean that they're American corporations? They're on their knees, you know, to the Chinese Communist Party. So, but yeah, I would always say I'm 100% pro-union. The unions are, I have huge differences of opinion with them about certain things, but collective bargaining is like, it's so important.
Yeah, that's where I'm at too. And it's just endlessly frustrating that the politics of those who lead the unions are so bad and so anti-working class.
Yeah.
I want to talk about Trump's impact on the working class, because he did actually enact some policies that I'm not sure that everyone is aware of that were helpful to the working class. You know, I think that the middle class and progressives and left obviously think of Trump as this I mean, they call him, you know, some kind of fascist dictator, and he hates women, and he hates the poor, and he hates Black people, and so he hates immigrants. But he actually did some good things. What were those things?
Yeah, he had a massive impact on working class Americans, both in terms of just vibes, like making them feel respected, but also like actual policies. I cannot overstate the impact he had on the conversation around trade in America. When Trump showed up, there was a handshake agreement between both parties that free trade was the way to go. Every job that could be exported to a, you know, some country that had lower standards for how to treat workers should be exported. NAFTA was like the law of the land. We exported 5 million really good paying jobs overseas. You know, the auto industry was hanging on by a thread. And Trump just turned that ship around. And he took on both parties to do that. I mean, it's like, in retrospect, it's unbelievable that this was possible. And yet he made a promise to his working class voters while he was campaigning. The one thing he talked about the most in 2015 on the campaign trail was NAFTA. I think that was the word he said the most often, you know? So NAFTA, trade, just saying like, actually, we're not going to be shipping good paying American jobs to China anymore. We're going to have a trade war with China. You know, actually, we're not going to be importing cheap aluminum and steel from China. We're going to put tariffs on. I mean, who heard the word tariffs in America before Trump? Like, it was verboten because the entire economist expert class was out here saying, you know, free trade lifts all boats. Tariffs are going to send us into a recession, blah, blah, blah. It all turned out to be garbage. And now Joe Biden has kept most of Trump's policies on trade. You know, this tacit admission that the Democrats had abandoned the working class on that front. He changed the conversation around this forever. There will never be another NAFTA because it is just a losing proposition. Like that alone, wherever working class Americans are clinging to the American dream, like there are millions of people whose children have a safe and stable future because of that. It's like just like on, like you cannot overstate the impact that that had. The elites never think about trade and never think about tariffs and never think about this stuff because it doesn't impact them at all. They never think about this stuff. They exist in abstractions, but working class people think about this all the time because they can see it in their bank accounts. Like they could see the difference. Immigration, they're, you know, it was Ronald Reagan who gave amnesty to 3 million immigrants. It was like we forget that both the Republicans and the Democrats had decided that mass migration was the future. Like the Republicans, because, you know, they love slave labor and they know it when they see it. Wall Street loves slave labor. Wall Street loves an open border. Silicon Valley loves an open border. You know, and Wall Street gave more money to Joe Biden than Donald Trump. Why? Because they want that border to be open. And they realize that that is the future with Democrats. What Trump did was he showed up and again took on the orthodoxy on both sides and said, we're not going to have an open border. We're going to have no immigrants. You know, we're going to have none of this illegal stuff. And he really held the line while being called a racist and a xenophobe by the elites of both parties. But he knew that this was where working class Americans were at. And now you look at the polling and this is where the majority of Americans say this is their number one issue. And meanwhile, Joe Biden promised he was going to decriminalize illegal border crossing. And that's exactly what he did. And he refuses to turn the ship around on that. And it's going to take another Trump presidency. But I hope at the end of that, the Democrats are going to realize what a huge mistake they made. So, you know, that stuff put money back in the pockets of the working class. If the economy had been totally weighted in favor of the elites, this sort of started to shift things like just a little bit, both in terms of saying to working class Americans, I see you, you're not a racist for wanting your children to have a future. And in terms of literally putting money back in their pockets, in 2019, the bottom 25% of wage earners saw a 4.5% wage increase for the first time since the 70s. And the top 25% only saw a 2% wage increase. So, of course, that's more money in, you know, like just final amount net. But the percentages, Trump was kind of evening things out a little bit again in a very real way.
Is there anyone that you favor for presidency? It may be obvious. after that response.
I'm honestly, I say I'm undecided. I'm not lying about that. I think
what do you right think about now, RFK? I'm an RFK fan, but I don't know that you are. I was just listening to an interview that you did with, I think his name is Matt Wells. Is that right? You seem maybe skeptical. Matt Lewis, thank you. Sorry, I wasn't familiar with who he was.
Yeah, so. I'm very skeptical of the RFK stuff. Yeah.
Okay.
First of all, he has no sense of humor, and I can't trust anybody with no sense of humor. But also, I
think that's fair.
I think he's a lot like Vivek. I think this is a kind of vanity thing for him. He has no stable ideology. I don't see anything. I know he cares a lot about the environment and that he stands for zero fossil fuels, which is class warfare on the working class. I know that he's an anti-vaxxer. I think that's really kind of dangerous. You know, it's one thing to be against vaccine, the COVID overreach, which I totally support, but to be like against the measles vaccine, I mean, what are we doing here? He's not that middle of the, you know, honestly, Trump is the centrist candidate. Trump is the guy whose views reflect 70% of Americans. And I don't
even on abortion.
Even on abortion.
People like pretend that there's like this extremist position, but Trump's views reflect the views of most Americans on abortion, I think.
On abortion, on trade, on immigration. He's courting the unions. He's courting black voters. I mean, it's just, he's a 90s era Democrat. And that's why they're trying to destroy him. Like, they cannot accept that that is the case because he reveals their abandonment of labor.
Hilarious. You know, I obviously am like hugely biased in favor of the working class. I like working class people better than middle and upper class people. I don't really want to hang around with upper class people. but I mean, I think that, again, like, one of the wonderful things that I was glad to learn from your book, and when I read this, I was like, this is totally true, is that the working class don't really care about politics that much. You know, the working class are not the people who are canceling each other because they voted differently or because they have a different opinion on whatever various policy, or even on like trans issues, even on race. You know, we like, I just find that, you know, it was just so refreshing to move to Mexico because nobody, you know, very few people are talking about politics. Like, when me and my friends are not out having political arguments, and I'm sure that we have different views on all sorts of things, but I don't care. I certainly don't care. You know, I've always been friends with people who have different political views. It's the rest of them that don't want to be friends with me. but you know, like, this isn't the way that the working class operates. This is the way that the elite operate, and they're imposing it on everybody else, and they're pretending as though everybody else operates this way, and it's just not true.
I couldn't agree more.
You know, how did you learn this? Like, what were people telling you? What were working class people telling you about their political views or about race or about all these like culture wars stuff and what they thought about people who they maybe had to work with who saw things differently than them?
Oh, they only had good things to say about their fellow Americans, like, who are working class. Everybody I met had people in their life who, you know, voted differently. Although, you know, it turned out, I think they assumed that their views were much more different from their coworkers who voted differently than they actually were. Because what I found was, like, they actually do agree, but they weren't aware of that as much. You know, people would, you know, have the feeling that, like, oh yeah, we know he's a Democrat, or like, yeah, we know that he likes Trump, like, you know, or she likes Trump. And they just didn't care. Like, it was so not an issue. It was just so not an issue. And I spoke to like a bunch of, you know, union electricians, for example, who knew that their bosses were Democrats. Like, they didn't care. You know, we all get along. We don't talk about it, and that's it, you know? And just very foreign to hyper-focus on politics the way that people in the elites do.
No, I mean, there's so many more interesting things to talk about, like gossiping about other people's relationships and stuff like that.
Totally.
I'm far more interested in who's sleeping with whom than what people's politics are. it is funny, like, it's just, you know, the only like two people in town who I've ever heard, you know, it's not of my doing. I don't, again, I don't really care what people think about anything politically here, but you know, the only two people who I've heard have been like around like trashing me or trying to cancel me in town. It didn't work. Or these two rich girls from California who are angry about my transphobia. And I was like, of course, because you're a rich girl from California. Get the fuck out of here. And no one cares.
Right. That's kind of the point, is like being a progressive is actually a marker of economic status. You know what I mean? Like that's at the end of the day, like scratch beneath the surface of a person accusing another person of transphobia, and you'll see like a very robust bank account that they're probably trying to hide, you know, from all the other people in their life.
Oh, absolutely. Well, thank you for writing this book for me. I really appreciate it.
It's very validating that you loved it. I it means a lot to me because you're such an authentic person and exactly who this book was for. So thank you so much, Megan.
For those listening, Bhatia's new book is called Second Class, How the Elites Betrayed America's Working Men and Women. And presumably it can be found everywhere books are sold, but let us know how to find it and how to follow you online and support your work.
You can buy it on Amazon. I think it's on sale right now for $19. So go and grab a copy. And yeah, I'm on Instagram, on Twitter. Don't waste your time looking for me on social media. Just read the book and, you know, follow Megan and her work. And hopefully I'll be back soon to talk even more. Thank you so much, Megan.
Yeah, thank you so much. It was great to talk with you again. I really appreciate it. I'm Megan Murphy, host of The Same Drugs. Thank you for tuning in. I produce and host this podcast all by myself and rely on individual donors like you to sustain my work. If you want to keep episodes free as well as free thinking, please consider signing up on Patreon at patreon.com/Megan Murphy, subscribing on Substack at www.meganmurphy.ca, or donating directly to support this podcast via PayPal at paypal.me/thesamedrugs. Another great way to support the podcast is by heading over to the Same Drugs podcast page on Spotify and clicking the follow button. Every little bit counts and ensures I can stay independent. Thank you so much for supporting conversations outside the algorithm.